Tonight, Be'ezrat Hashem, we are learning Parshat Ki Tetzeh. This is the parsha that has the most mitzvos in the Torah. And I want to dedicate our learning tonight to Liora Bat Eida. Hashem should bless her. And Be'ezrat Hashem, this year, she should be under the chuppah and build a blessed home together with her Basher swiftly and happily. The parasha has so many mitzvot that I want us to change from the way we usually learn the parasha. Usually we run through the parasha and then we review it with more depth. This time we'll just run through the parasha. Hopefully we'll do a good part of it tonight. And whatever is left, if you guys want, we'll try to finish up tomorrow night. The parasha begins describing the Jewish people going out to war. And we have three types of war. We have a war that's a mitzvah. There is milchemet mitzvah, if the Jewish people are endangered, or conquering the land of Israel. In the time that Joshua entered the land of Israel, God said, we're supposed to take over the land. That's a war that was a mitzvah. Everyone participated, everyone in whatever capacity they could help. We also have milchemet chova, an obligatory war. And we have milchemet reshut, a war that's just, we need to expand our boundaries. We don't really have to go to war. This is an important concept, that within the Torah, certain mitzvot are more obligatory than others. For example, Torah says you have to put a mezuzah on your doorpost. Does that mean you have to buy a house to put a mezuzah on the doorpost? No. If you have a house and you have a doorpost, you put up a mezuzah. If you live in a tent, no mezuzah. And there are certain mitzvot that are that way. So when we're going to learn the mitzvot throughout the Torah, we have to pause and recognize what are the mitzvot telling us. The Torah tells us that when we go out to war, so it was common in those days that when a nation thought they were going to lose, so the women would get all decked out, and they'd come out and try to seduce the men, hoping that the men would marry them, and then they wouldn't be hurt by the war. They'd be the wife of a general or something. So the Torah says, what happens if you're going to war and you see one of these women and you're attracted? So the Torah says you could marry her. And there's a procession if you want to marry her. Bring her home. She shaves her hair. She lets her nails grow long. She takes off all those beautiful garments she was wearing to seduce you. She has to wear simple garments, and give her a month to realize that she is becoming Jewish, she's leaving her pagan ways, to weep over her family that she lost at war. Don't be an animal. Let her have a month to recover from the trauma that she's had. At the end of that month, that you've spent a month seeing her without all the all the glamour she put on to attract you. You've seen her without all the hairdos and the beautiful clothing. No, she shaved her hair. She's letting her nails grow long. She's weeping. If you still want to marry her, then you can marry her.
Is it also possible that she cuts her nails off entirely?
Two opinions.
Right. Exactly the opposite, though. Like, that's weird.
Okay. She does not have the option, but that needs to be discussed. Meaning, there's more to it than that.
If she won't convert, aren't you allowed to
I don't want to go into depth. If we really want to understand this mitzvah, about what are her options, what can she do, what can she say, that we'll have to discuss. But the Torah here gives us the capacity to marry her. And the Torah says, but think about it. You have a month to think about it. What are you attracted to here? You see a girl. You know, this is a question we get every year in our dating class. Guys learn that the modest form of dating is that you don't approach a girl directly. There's an intermediary. Girls aren't, Jewish girls are supposed to be something that's cherished. You don't just pick one up in the marketplace. So if there's a girl that a person would want to go out with, the halacha expects that you do through a third party, out of respect for the girl. You don't just pick her up at a New Year's Eve party, right? So guys say, well, what happens if you are at a New Year's Eve party, or you're at a wedding, or you're at someplace and you see a girl? And here's where it gets tricky. So if you'll hear our old dating classes, you'll hear the way guys worded it. They say, Let's say you see a girl and you really like her. So I always ask, what do you mean you like her? Have you spoken to her? No. So how do you know you like her? So that's what's happening in our parsha. He sees the girl, he's attracted, and then he starts liking her. Well, he doesn't really like her. He likes what he sees, or what he thinks the joy that she'll give him. It's all external. Yeah?
That's not true. You can tell more about from body language than you can from what a person says.
Okay. So the Torah tells us that we were given time to test and see the truth. We remove all the coverings and then we look. Torah tells us if you marry her, you should know chances are you won't like her then. And chances are she won't bring up your kids well because she didn't choose this lifestyle. She was in a situation where she had to go this route. What's she going to tell your children about Judaism? What's she going to tell them? You'll end up having a wife that you won't like as much, and you'll end up having kids that might rebel against you, might go in improper ways. So here we have an interesting mitzvah. Our sages say that King David did this. He was once at war, there was a girl, he was attracted, she wanted to marry him, he married her, he had a child from her, he had a daughter from her, they were both very, very good looking. That daughter got raped by her brother, and then that son ended up leading a rebellion against King David and almost killing him, destroying the kingdom. And at one point, King David was approached by the prophet, and King David said, I've had it. He was covered with leprosy, he was mourning, he was walking barefoot, he thought he lost everything. So the prophet said to him, who asked you to marry that girl? So he said, the Torah permits it. So the prophet said, yeah, but the Torah doesn't recommend it. You find that the Torah says, directly following this mitzvah, the Torah says, and what happens if you have two wives, one who you hate? The Torah is indicating if you do this, you're going to end up hating her. And then the Torah says, and what happens if you have a son that's a rebellious son? The Torah is indicating you do this, you'll end up with a rebellious son. King David says, oh, I didn't know that. So this is all what the Torah forecasted would happen. Okay, he puts the shoes back on, he realizes he does tshuva. Our sages say King David was on the verge of leaving the faith. If you guys think that part of being a religious Jew is not having questions, you haven't learned anything yet. Everyone in history had questions. Part of being religious is thinking and having questions, and sometimes the questions are more powerful and sometimes less, and sometimes life puts it more in our face and sometimes less. Our sages say King David was on the verge of walking out. David HaMelech wrote the Tehillim, big person, right? On the verge of walking out. But he had a Rebbe who grabbed him and said, don't go. And said, it's your fault. Recognize what you did wrong. So he did. So here the Torah says you could do it. Our sages say, Lo dibra Torah la keneged yetzerara. The Torah spoke corresponding to our yetzerara. The Torah said, if I tell him don't do it, I know there's a possibility he will be overtaken with compassion and he won't listen to me. So the Torah says, you know what? I'll tell you how to do it. If you want to do it, I'll tell you how to do it. Here's how you do it. And after you've done it this way, chances are you're not going to want to do it. You'll realize yourself that it's the wrong way to go. But the Torah gives us capacity to do this. So let's stop and think. Here the Torah said, I know that if I tell you not to do it, you won't listen to me. Does the Torah say that about any other mitzvah? Huh? So what's the Torah telling us? There's one time you're away from home, you're in the middle of a war, you're fighting for your life, and there's a girl who's working on seducing you. In this scenario, the Torah says, I know that if I just tell you no, you won't listen to me. So here's how you do it, and you'll overcome, and then you'll recognize yourself that this isn't the route to go. But what does that tell us about all the other 612 mitzvot? Right? Okay. That everything else is within our reach. We don't have this excuse anywhere else. All other mitzvot, the person shouldn't kid himself and say, oh, that's too tough for me. Slowly, maybe not today, but it's within your reach. It's not like this. Here the Torah says, I know if I tell you no, then you're not going to listen. So I'll tell you how to do it so that you'll ultimately understand you shouldn't do it. Good question. Complicated answer. Let's leave that. The answer is yes and no. The way you think it is, it's not. Technically, it is. That's the answer. The Torah says, what happens if after the month you realize that this isn't for me? So then you say, okay, I'll sell her. No, says the Torah. You put her through all of that, you let her go. You have not, you can't abuse her and then say, fine, I'm not going to marry you, so I'm just going to sell you. No. At the end of the day, the Torah says you let her go. She wants to go back home. She wants to do what she wants. You have nothing to do with her. Yeah, David.
Isn't it similar to shooing the mother bird away from the nest? Like, you don't have to, and you're going to do it anyway, so do it correctly.
Okay. Okay.
And even shafting an animal, you don't have to eat meat.
Right? Okay.
Do it the proper way. Is it really like that anomalous?
I could hear it. If you want to compare it, I guess you could. The Torah tells us... Yes?
I just have a question. Why specifically in the scope of the war, why wouldn't it be like when you're traveling or you see a woman like harness it? Just like in this case, but just after the war, saying...
Okay, so we'll go on a small tangent. The Talmud tells us that God created a Yetzer Hara, desire to do bad. And the first thing we should know about the Yetzer Hara is that when it comes to creation, God says he saw creation and it was very good. So the Talmud, the Medrash says, good is the Yetzer Tov, the desire to do good. Very good is the Yetzer Hara. What does that mean? Yetzer Hara is described as very good. So in Judaism, we don't view the Yetzer Hara as a terrible thing to be abolished. No. God says, Barati Yetzer Hara, Barati Lo Torah Tavlin. I created the Yetzer Hara, I created the Torah. Torah is not called the antidote, because the Yetzer Hara is not a disease. The Torah is called the spice. When you spice something, you give it its proper flavor. The Yetzer Hara is positive. When the men of the Great Assembly succeeded in subduing the desire for idol worship, they said, boy, this is doing so good, let's subdue the desire for adultery, the desire for promiscuity. So the Talmud says they did that, and the next morning no chicken lay an egg, and the world wouldn't produce, nothing moved. So they said, okay, we got to bring it back, the world can't function without it. The Yetzer Hara is something positive, it's something though that has to be channeled. It's a desire, which is positive. It moves us forward. It just has to be channeled. The Torah channels it. Ordinarily, the Talmud tells us two scenarios. The Talmud says, "Im ro'eh adam sheitzo mitgaber alav," if a person sees that his desire is overtaking him, he should move the Yetzer Tov to fight back. How does he do that? He reminds himself of reading Shema, he reminds himself what the Torah wants of him. He focuses on learning Torah. He does all kinds of things. He challenges the Yetzer Hara with the Yetzer Tov. He challenges the desire to do bad with the desire to do good. There's another Gemara that says, "Im pagata v'mnuval ze." If you've met up with this derelict, mashcheu lebet ha-midrash. Draw him into the academy. Draw him into the base medrash. What's the difference? So there are two types of Yetzer Hara. Really, there are three. One is internal. A guy sitting at home doesn't have the internet on, doesn't see any dirty pictures, but his mind starts wandering. So then the Talmud says, "Im ro'eh adam sheitzo mitgaber alav," if a person sees from within his desires overtaking him, so channel your thoughts a different way. It's starting from within, so you overcome it from within. You could do that. "Im pagata b'mnuval ze," but what happens if you met up with him? You're surfing the net and suddenly a picture pops up. You're walking in the street and suddenly you see a certain house. So then the Talmud says, then it's not enough to start doing a psychological war, fighting from within, because there's something out there that's attracting. So draw him to the base medrash. Go into the base medrash. It's external, so bring something external to help you overcome the war. When a person's in his day-to-day life, whatever the Yetzer Hara is, we say channel it. If a person likes to see blood, let him be a doctor. Let him operate on people. Let him be a butcher. You have a certain desire, channel it. A guy likes bossing people around, let him be the gabbai in shul. You know, fine. People like thrills, so let them be a fireman. You know, there are ways to channel every attitude to be positive. There we don't have an excuse. But here you have a guy, he's traveled away from his family, he's away from his wife and kids, he's out there at war fighting for his life, and in the middle of it all, there's a girl that's trying to seduce him. There the Torah says, you know, in this dire circumstance, if I tell him no, he won't listen. So I'm going to work with him. And here we also see a very important concept. The when people first approach the Torah, so the first feeling that a person has is, this is tough. This is like strange. It's much easier living life the way I'm used to leading life. And the Torah seems to be something that's unnatural, that's forced. So now I'm going to have to do this way? The truth is that the life we're leading, that's not like the Torah, is unnatural. We're used to it, but that's unnatural. And the Torah is really the most in sync thing in the world. It's the most in sync guidebook with a human being. God says, I created you. I'm telling you how to live. What does Torah mean? Instruction. God says, I know who you are. I know what you're made of. I created you. And I gave you a gift. I'll show you how to lead life. But to us, the Torah, we're so far from it that we have to take the mitzvot slowly, one at a time. Because when a person first comes in, he's been living 25 years, 30 years, a different type of lifestyle. So then it's difficult. But that's only because he's used to an unnatural lifestyle. But, you know, I have a friend who's a compulsive eater. You know what a compulsive eater means?
Just keeps on eating.
That means if there are 3 tubs of ice cream in the fridge, he asks you, why don't you have 4? Because you walk into the kitchen and he's finished all 3. And you ask him, were you that hungry? He says, no. He goes, why'd you finish it? But it was there. I know it was there. I mean, this guy comes to our house, and my wife just baked cookies for a kiddush. So he says, can I have a cookie? So we like him, sure. We take out the box, we put out the box. We continue what we're doing, we're coming back, all the cookies for the kiddush are gone. Why? It was there. Now, you tell a guy, you know, you got to get used to living life a little differently. You can eat 2 cookies. You can eat 4 cookies. You don't eat cookies for a whole kiddush, like 50 people in one sitting. You know? You don't eat 3 tubs of ice cream. The guy looks at you and says, you don't like me anymore, do you? Right? You're telling me this abnormal way of life. Whenever we're used to something, something else seems strange. But that doesn't mean it's strange. Could be our perspective. So the Torah is the most in sync, and the Torah also knew when it could, when it couldn't.
When we wouldn't have the power, so to speak.
Correct. But that also is an indication that every other mitzvah. Let's move forward. We have a lot to cover. The Torah says if a person has children from 2 wives, and he really prefers 1 son, he can't play around with his inheritance. You don't play favorites and say, I'm going to give the other son the double lot. And this, our sages said that lo'lam al yishane adam b'no ben abanim. A person should never treat children differently. A person might have 1 child who he's more in sync with, one child whose nature and temperament is more pleasant to him, and another child who drives him up the wall. And he could barely spend an hour with that kid. There's nothing you can do about it. Some kids are going to have temperament which you can handle better, and I hope that your wives will be able to handle the kids that you can't handle better. But at the end of the day, we have to be clear that we love them all. And the Torah prohibits us from playing games with the inheritance. Our sages say the reason we ended up in exile in Egypt was because the patriarchs, the avos, were not fair with their children. They erred on this point. The Torah describes a child who is rebellious. You talk to him, he's not listening. You try to teach him, he's not willing to learn. And then you see he's starting to steal. And then you see that he's not only stealing, but he's taking on a gluttonous way of life. And you recognize he's showing clear signs, the amount of wine he's consuming on an average day, and that the amount of meat he's consuming, there's no way he's going to end up without being abandoned. So we take him out to the elders, and they execute him. Very cruel. Never happened.
Even lashes first, 39 lashes, right?
Let's begin. Has to be that his father and mother are of the same height, have the same voice. There are so many details, it's impossible basically to happen. So what's the Torah telling us? The Torah is telling us there are many factors in educating a child. There are many factors. And the Torah is telling us at the end of the day, you can have a child that's going to go their own way, but you always have to look back and say, wait a second. Were the parents educating together? Were they educating as partners? Or were they contradicting one another? Were they both listening to him? They have to have the capacity to understand him. He has to have the capacity to understand them. They have to have the capacity to educate him. You know, this whole story, the whole procession has to happen within a period of 6 months. From the first time they warn him, till he starts doing all these things, till they take him to the court, etc. It's almost impossible it should happen. But the Talmud tells us it never happened. But it teaches us something about chinuch. And it also teaches us that we as parents have tremendous responsibility, and at the end of the day, a child has his free will. Parents sometimes say, you got to bring up a kid this way. It doesn't work that way. You have to give him the capacity to be a successful adult. At the end of the day, just like we choose our path, they're going to choose their paths. We have to try and give them all the foundation that they'll choose a proper path. Rav Tashani. The Torah tells us, what happens if a person, he goes and serves an idol? You warn him, you know, you're going to get the death penalty. He doesn't care. There are witnesses. He doesn't care. He goes and he does sins or a sin for which he ultimately gets hung. So he's a pretty bad person. He was warned. He was taken to court. And at the end of the day, he didn't care. He did it anyways. Still says the Torah, don't leave the body hanging till nightfall. The body is a representation of God. And this tells us something. It's not only a person who's pious that's a representation of God. It's even the lowest person in society. Want to know more than that? People sometimes say about a Jew, Yimach Shemo. You know what the Pasuk says? Yimach Shemo. It's a Pasuk in Tehillim. May his name be erased. May he be destroyed. It's a whole long verse about how King David curses his enemies. We don't say that about a Jew. I'll prove it to you. It's not my proof. I don't remember which rabbi pointed it out. There's a halacha that if a Jew dies without children, so his wife gets married by his brother so that he has a remembrance in the world. The halacha discusses what happens if a Jew left the faith. He went and became an apostate. He drove the church against the Jews. He was the worst Jew you could think of. And then he died without kids. So his brother says, I don't want to leave any remembrance of a guy like that. Why should I marry his widow? The halacha says he still has a mitzvah to marry the widow. What does that show us? That at the core, even a person who has done terrible things, at the end of the day, there's still something positive about him. Something that's a representation of God that we don't want to lose. And so, even the person who ultimately was hung, the Torah gives us a mitzvah, don't leave him hanging till nightfall. There's still a representation of God within that person. And if you do, the Torah says you've defiled your land. It's not only his body, it's a defilement for us. Now, we also have a mitzvah to bury a person that day. From here we derive, in Judaism, we don't delay burials. Whenever we can, we bury a person right away. That's why here in Jerusalem, you'll hear sometimes there's a funeral procession at 11 o'clock at night. We don't delay it. As soon as we can, we put the body in the ground and let it lay it to rest. Yeah, you don't.
The curse of Machshimo, like, is a Jew, that's a really bad thing to do?
It's a really bad thing to do. It's just, it doesn't seem from the halacha that it's a correct thing to say.
Last night, talking to somebody, and said that about somebody, and
people don't know. So there are a lot of things we don't know.
Yeah. Which pasuk was the name of
it? I don't remember. Sorry.
Did he say for a woman, not Shema?
I guess, yeah. The Torah gives us a mitzvah if we encounter a lost item, an ox, a sheep. So the Torah says, what, will you ignore it? Return, you shall return it to your brother. So here we have a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. You see your neighbor's lost object, you see a lost object, anyone's lost object, you don't even know whose it is, you have a mitzvah to return it. What happens if you're walking, if you're on your way to an important meeting, there's a pen on the floor. That pen's worth about one shekel, your time is worth about 10 shekels, you don't bend down to pick up the pen. Halacha says, your time is also worth something. If you're busy right now, and your time is worth more than that is worth to the person, and your time, you don't take from your time. Technically, there's a whole tractate, there's a whole chapter in Tractate Bava Metzia that describes the laws of this. The Talmud, the Torah describes it, shall you, you will ignore it in questioning form. From here we derive, sometimes you do ignore it. And here we have the concept of kavod abrios, respect. Sometimes a person's an old man. He doesn't go out on his own to move his garbage cans. He always has his servants or his children doing it. He walks out, he sees the neighbor's garbage cans are out in the street. He doesn't have to go and deal with those garbage cans because that's beneath his dignity. And here we see the Torah takes into account elements of dignity. It's not a mitzvah, but there are levels of dignity. The Torah says, Hashev Teshivan, return you shall return it. You return your neighbor's lawnmower. You return your neighbor's dog. Next week you're on your way to shul, you see the dog again. I told him you should lock it up, you bring him back. He says, I'm so sorry, I locked it up. I don't know how he got away. Okay. Torah says even 100 times. Even 100 times. You have to bring it back, you have mitzvah to return it. Yeah?
Oh, Rabbi, what if you, like, let's say today, I'm walking on the street and you find something really expensive. like a laptop or some a gun or something like that. Is it okay to return it to the police? Like, you just tell the police, hey, look, I found this expensive thing. I don't want to take responsibility for it. Could you take care of it and return it?
I don't know enough. I would think it's okay. I mean, but I don't know enough to answer that. About a gun, yeah. I want to warn you one thing about a gun. Purim time. I went into the bathroom, and I see a gun lying there. And it was a little bit before Purim, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm holding this gun towards my head. And I'm saying, cap guns this early, and I'm about to pull the trigger. And then I said, wait a second, this is Israel. And I look at the gun, and it was a real gun. So I had gone to the bathroom and just left his gun there, or his gun dropped out of his pocket. So here in Israel, when you find the gun, don't be so sure it's a cap gun. And, you know, I was looking at it thinking, cap gun this early in the year, it's not yet Purim. And guns you should give the police. You don't want, you don't know what crime has been committed with that gun, right? The Torah says if you find the lost object, you don't know whose it is, so hold on to it till you find the guy who lost it. And then you seek him out. The Torah tells us you don't just give it back, you ask him questions. You question him, you find out if he's a liar or not. And this is a concept we discuss often. The Torah, being religious doesn't equal being stupid. Quite the contrary. Latet liftaim oman. The Torah is supposed to give us cunning. That means that you don't get duped. Pop-up ad shows up. You're the millionth customer on this site. You just won. Just give us your credit card information and we'll give you all the money, right? Okay, guys. Torah is supposed to teach us to be smart. We're if it seems too good to be true, it is. Not it probably is. It is. The Torah says, you found a lost object. You have a mitzvah to give it back. You have a mitzvah to wait and question the guy. Give me a sign. What's called in Hebrew a siman. It was your wallet? Fine, tell me, what signs are there on the wallet? When you advertise, you found something. You don't advertise things that will give away the simanim. Yeah?
Could, in the previous example, the police just act as an agent for you to fulfill the mitzvah?
If you give it to the police, you should just know. It was, if you give something of value to the police, make sure they give you a piece of paper that you gave it to them. Because the law in Israel is that after 30 days, you get to have it.
Yeah.
There was a girl here in this neighborhood, rented an apartment that used to belong to someone in the mafia. And they happened to forget a suitcase with a million shekel in the apartment. So she went to the police. True story. She went to the police and said, I found a suitcase with a million shekel. So the police were very interested. And no one came to claim it. So she was a lawyer. So after the month, she said, legally it's mine. So the police said, no. Because we're scared that maybe you're in the mafia. If we'll just let you have it, then you're getting tax-free million. So she took the police to court. And after a few months, she got the million shekel. The court sided with her.
Tax-free?
Tax-free. I mean, well, that's a different story, but they said maybe this is money that was laundered, and this is a way. Every mafioso could walk in and say, you know, I found $1 million. Right? Okay, so that was the police's claim why they didn't want to give her back the million shekel. She got it. She won in court. I'm just saying, if you find it, if it's something of value, going back to your question, practically, you should get something in writing that you found it, because legally here it's yours after 30 days. That doesn't mean halachically that's so, but that's a different question. What happens if you're not sure if this is your pen, right? So you could put up a sign. You could take the pen, put up a sign, and say, if it's someone's come to me. And then you say, well, maybe it's someone who left Machon Mir. So you could use the pen and have in mind, if anyone ever comes to me and says it was his, I'll give it back to him. Or I'll give him the equivalent value. Meaning I don't have to leave it by me, taking up space, etc. I could use it on the condition that if he ever shows up, I'll give him the equivalent value. He doesn't care if it's this Parker pen or that Parker pen. I'll give it to him. And you leave a sign, etc. In each case, you'll ask the rabbi how to deal with it. Yeah?
A monetary equivalent of something that's not worth...
Depends on your time. Depends on that...
No. That someone... It's not worth for somebody to come back
for... Depends on the location. Meaning in Africa it's one thing, in New York, here in Israel, I don't know. Okay, the Torah tells us if it's your friend's lost object, you cannot ignore it. And here the Torah is referring to that inner voice. An old person gets on the bus, I can make believe I didn't see it. There's a lost object on the floor, I can make believe I didn't see it. The Torah deals with who we are for real. God isn't interested with what other people will think. Like you didn't see it, right? God's interested what's really in us. Of course, God's also interested, our sages say, your reputation counts in heaven as well. Meaning, your reputation down below counts up above. But in this regard, it's a question between us and God. Just saying, yeah.
Sometimes, like, I found contact and just left it where it was because I figured the person will come back
Right. If you think it's in a place where a person would come back for it, so then it's better to leave it. Correct. So that depends on the value. And you don't always have that option. You find a laptop, you can't just not... I'll leave it here. You find tefillin, right?
There's a website.
Okay, there are all kinds of websites and stuff for lost and found. Okay, the Torah prohibits a man from wearing a woman's garment and a woman from wearing a man's garment. Now, this pertains to garments of beauty. It means like a man isn't supposed to shave his armpits and his arms. Those are things that are done by women, shave his legs.
What if you're really embarrassed by your
body? Some person will ask his local Orthodox rabbi. Technically, this applies not only to the clothing we wear, it also applies to the way we, the different things like shaving that we do. Now what about slippers? Who could tell between men's slippers and women's slippers? So the halacha says things that are worn for warmth, that's okay. If you need to take out the garbage, you want to throw on your wife's coat, that's okay. Things that are for warmth are okay. But technically a man isn't supposed to wear a skirt and a woman isn't supposed to wear a man. What? On Purim there is room to be lenient. Yeah. Cologne we're lenient about. I mean, in the times of the Talmud, it was... in the time of the Talmud, only women and men who were looking to attract other men wore cologne. So, in the time of the Talmud, if you wore cologne, it said something. In our day and age, it's different. Yeah?
Oh, Rabbi, what about like if you have a dress that in one place is considered like to be for men? And if you come to Israel, that same dress is considered not...
a kilt. Yeah. I think it depends on the place.
For example, in India, the place where my mom comes from, there's like they wear the tunic kind of thing that the guy looks exactly like a woman.
Yeah, yeah.
For him, according to his standards, that's a man's dress. And he comes here, everyone laughs at him and says...
Right. So I think it goes by the place. I think so. I haven't reviewed these halachos recently, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure. Oh, he says, good. The Torah tells us if you come across a bird's nest and the mother's there with the children, we have a special mitzvah. Don't take the children before the mother. Don't take the eggs before the mother. Shoo her away before you do it. And then God says you'll have longevity, which is talking about the world to come, not this world. You build a home. The Torah says you have to put a railing on the roof if you have a roof that's being used. And this applies not only to the roof, but any other thing that could be a source of danger. So if you have a ladder that's unsafe, you're not allowed to leave it where people could use it. You have to put a sign on it. If you have a toaster oven that can short circuit, you have a socket that's open and the kids can touch it. Anything that can pose a danger, the Torah prohibits us from leaving it there in a way that's dangerous. Biblical mitzvah. People take this lightly. I don't know why. The Torah says you're not allowed to leave a source of hazard in your home. Yeah?
Does this depend on the person that's foreseeable to do it? Like, if you live alone out in the woods, all right, and you don't have any friends or family, right? But let's just say there's a trespasser that comes, I mean, are you liable for a trespasser?
You see here, a person could say, what do I need a railing for? I know when I go on my roof, I'll be careful. And the Torah still says, put a railing.
But even like, let's say like a socket that's like exposed, and you know it's exposed, but you haven't had anyone, you know. But I mean, like, but a trespasser comes, and they, you know, I don't know, plug in there, whatever. I mean, like, I understand it's a crazy thing, but I'm just trying to like
touch their.
No, so we assume in a normal.
Exactly.
No, yes. Trespassers we're not worried about because haliteo la rasha v'yamut. He has no right to be there. He wants to eat your poison berries thinking they're good kosher berries. That's his problem. You don't even have to say anything.
Okay,
he wants to drop dead. His problem. That we're not worried about. But we do assume that a home is a place that other people will come.
So it's just foreseeable people.
We assume that right now, you think whenever I'll go up to the roof, I'll be okay.
Yeah.
And it's enough that it'll happen the one time that you'll go up in the dark or there'll be an oil slick up there or something like that. Even a railing. Most of the time, you're careful. Mm-hmm. The problem is the one time you aren't. So that's why this would apply even so. I think so. I don't remember the source offhand, but if I'm not mistaken, that's...
It's only a flat roof, right?
Correct. It's only a flat roof. A roof that's in use. If you go up to your roof to fix the shingles, so you don't have to put it because that's not in use. You only go up there to fix the shingles. Okay,
if
so for that.
If you put a satellite dish on the roof, there's a chance somebody's going to go up there.
That's not called in use. No. So he has to be careful. That's like saying I have to put on every tree. I also, sometimes we have to climb up the tree to take down a ball or something. No, it has to be something that's a normal use. Yeah.
Did these rules apply for instance, like finding something that's lost? If the person's not Jewish, do these rules apply? You have to go out of your way to help a non-Jew as well?
So the rules are slightly different. There it depends on many factors. It depends on what the law is. It depends on what the odds are that he's around. If you give it to him, there we have different series of laws. The Torah demands of us more as where we owe one another. The Torah expects us to view every person as a brother, and that's why the Torah, for example, says you're not allowed to say something that might, in the long run, cause some harm. What do you mean? I didn't cause them any harm. Yeah, but maybe it'll cause harm. That's Lashon Hara. No, that's for a Jew. For a non-Jew, you can't do him harm, but you don't have to worry. If you said something, maybe in the long run, that'll cause harm. Lashon Hara is going 10 steps beyond the call of duty. Well, 10 steps beyond the call of duty is something we owe one another. The Torah says that when you lend a Jew money, because you're all part of the Jewish people, you're supposed to treat one another like brethren. Don't take interest from him. A non-Jew, it's like anyone else. I don't owe him that kindness. I can take, it's a nice thing not to take. It's a commendable thing not to take. The verse says, Kaspolo natan b'neshech, an extra pious person, even when he lends a non-Jew, he also won't take interest. But the idea is that there are certain privileges. If you're my brother, so then to my brother I'm going to give an interest-free loan. If you're not my brother, so I'm not doing anything mean to you, I'm just being fair. If you'd give me a loan, you'd take interest, so I'm entitled to make money the same way. It's normal. It's unusual that the Torah says to the next Jew, you have to treat him like a brother. And these mitzvot are to be viewed that way. The Torah says go beyond the call of duty for him. Just a second, I was waiting, yeah.
Rabbi, you just reminded me something about the Lashon Hara thing.
So let's wait, it's not this week's parsha, we got too much to cover. Yeah.
What about,
sorry.
You know, like a lot of people like to put those rubber things on the corner of the table when they have kids?
Yeah.
So, now if someone else, are you obligated, if somebody brings his kids over to your house, to go the extra mile to make sure there's tell your house for children?
That I don't know. It depends on what you have out. If all your sharp knives are on display, I don't know.
Okay, maybe not just leave a butcher knife out.
Right. So it's a little hard to delineate. That's just being a responsible host, right? Or maybe just don't have those kids over. No, I'm serious. The Torah prohibits planting kalayim, taking two types of seeds and crossbreeding. We're not allowed to do that. We're not even allowed to ask a Gentile to do that on our behalf. We're not allowed to. The fruits, if a non-Jew grew, he crossbred fruits or vegetables, we're allowed to eat the fruits, and we're even allowed to plant that new breed.
Do you make a bracha? There was a discussion. I don't know about. Do you make a bracha because, it's not like a naturally occurring thing, right? People make it. So do you bless God and you make a bracha?
I think so. It still grew on a tree. The Torah prohibits us from plowing with an ox and a donkey together, and this applies not only to an ox and a donkey, any two animals. And that's also a form of kilayim, and the Torah says we're not allowed to wear wool and linen together. So, that's called shatnez. If you buy a cheap suit, so it's a good thing to check it. They have a shatnez checker here in this neighborhood, and every Jewish neighborhood usually have someone who checks. If you buy an exceptionally expensive suit, if you're going to wear a suit that's like $600, $700, $800, so then you have to check. Like the Hugo Boss, depends on where it's manufactured. Some of them are known that they have shatnez. I have a gemach where I give out shirts and suits and pants, and let me know if you guys want white shirts and pants and stuff like that. So I once got a donation from a millionaire. He sent me a bunch of suits, all $800 to $1,000 suits. So every guy I gave them to, I said, you have to check it for shatnez. I don't see the label. It doesn't say it was checked for shatnez, so you have to check it. So they all checked it, and they all came up with shatnez. The guy is a frum Jew, And he's built educational institutions and he didn't know this. So he was wearing shatnez all these years. So they had to invest 150 shekel to change the lining. And you know what? For 150 shekel, you get an $800 suit. They still came out ahead. So, yeah.
Had the people you gave the suits to not been... have you not thought that they would actually check them? Would you have been allowed to give them?
I don't think so, because they were Hugo Boss. And Hugo Boss is known. It's one brand, but there are other brands that are known that in the collar of their expensive suits, they have chatnez, and they really did have chatnez.
So you were relying on the fact...
I wasn't relying. When I gave it to them, I said, you have to check it. And these were people who I knew would. They were students at the Machon. Sure. I believe you guys.
If you didn't really think that they would have it checked, would you be allowed to give it to them?
I don't know, but I mean,
not
necessarily, because I don't know that there's a stumbling block. Meaning, I don't know that there's a problem. There might be a problem, right? It's not exactly the same thing, and they might check. So I don't know. I think that the people here at the Mahon are trustworthy. I trust everyone here. Yeah.
You can give it as a present to a non-Jew, right? Because you became benefit.
That's okay.
You can.
Yeah. Okay. We have a mitzvah putting tzitzis. Now, technically, if the tzitzis are very hot for you, you don't have to wear tzitzis. The mitzvah tzitzis is when you wear a four-cornered garment, the four-cornered garment should have tzitzit. What are tzitzit? Tzitzit are strings that were made for the sake of the mitzvah. You can't just buy any strings. And they were put in the holes on the corner. Where on the corner? From this much of the thumb up to three. I don't remember. Three, I think it's three. Up to three.
So,
I don't remember, but the tzitzit you buy are usually okay. Technically, they should have gedilin ptil. They should have a part that's woven, that's circled around and knotted, and a part that strings. If you guys want, we can make it, but Rav Siegel usually makes it with you guys. So, if you want, if anyone wants, come to me, I'll show you how to make it. In 5 minutes, you could be pros. It's very easy, it's not hard. What? It's very easy. In 5 minutes, you can close. Okay. Yeah.
Isn't there something that says that if you say Shema without tzitzit, testifying against
yourself? No, it says it about tefillin, not tzitzit. Right. So every time you wear tzitzit, you're performing a mitzvah. Every second you're wearing it, you could take tzitzit of wool that's a certain stringency, but you could also wear tzitzit of a cotton. And if the garment is cotton, you could still have wool strings in the tzitzit. You could buy them very cheaply in the shuk, or make sure that the strings that you buy have a hechsher, because the tzitzit has to be made for the sake of the mitzvah of tzitzit. The halacha says, even though technically one can walk around all day without tzitzit, you don't have to wear tzitzit, but in a time of danger, tzitzit speak up for a person. God forbid a person is on a bus where there's a bomber. So at a time of danger, God says, if he's wearing tzitzit, that's a mitzvah that speaks on his behalf. It's like an extra protection. So a person has to know that he never knows when he's in potential harm's way. He should know that tzitzit is the mitzvah that speaks up on our behalf, and you want to forego that, you could. What I do when I'm hot is I put the tzitzis on top of the garment. I'm here in Beis Medrash. This is my house. I could do what I want, right? So in Beis Medrash, Merkaz Arav, wherever I was, they always knew I'm the guy with the tzitzis on top of his garments. I found it hot. That way I got the mitzvah, and it wasn't too hot. You wear wool directly over your undershirt. Under your shirt, that could be really hot. But if you don't want to wear tzitzit, you have to know that you're not sinning. You could have the mitzvah, and you're not. It's not a sin. Yeah,
you
don't.
You said that it had fine.
I didn't say that. He said that. Yeah.
But what did you say, Shema? Well, you don't remember that you're in the morning.
Right.
So you say Shema more than once.
Because at night, your night is not a time that you're obligated to wear.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Rabbi, let's just say you wear tzitzit, but you keep tucking the strings in your pants.
You could tuck the strings in the pants, no problem. Yeah.
The strings touch the body.
Yeah.
What does it mean to testify against yourself?
That means that when you say Shema, what are you reading? You're reading that it says you should wear tefillin, and you're not. You're quoting testimony. You're quoting the parsha that says you should wear tefillin. Yeah.
If one of the strings gets frayed or shortened,
it's okay. No.
What about
the halacha is if it's more than one, how short it became, etc. But if one, you have nothing to worry about. Yeah. Just a second. Let Ben finish. Yeah.
Sorry, if there's an extra knot. Yeah, I think one side.
That's okay. preferably you shouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
The next biggest problematic is
each person will ask his local Orthodox rabbi. Yeah.
Does it have to be any color?
The garment could be any color. The strings technically could be any color, but you have to buy strings that were made in for the sake of tzitzit. After you've bought strings that were made for the sake of tzitzit, so then you could dye them for the sake of tzitzit. Now, white is good for any color garment, and all other colors should correspond to the color of the garment. Meaning, if you're in the army and they demand that all your garments be green, that's what people usually do, is they get green paint, they put it in a pot, and then they cook the tzitzit and the garment, or they buy a green tzitzit, or they buy a white tzitzit, and then they cook it with green paint, and then the tzitzit are green and the garment's green, and that's okay. But you have to watch to make sure that it's really green, because it's pikuach nefesh. There's a reason why you have to be green. So if you're going to make it green, make it good green. So don't play games with it. And if the green wears out, do it again, or don't wear the tzitzit. Yeah?
Rabbi, regarding that tehillah, is it okay to get the glue paint and just paint one strand of the tzitzit?
No. Tchelet, and the Torah gives us the mitzvah. Tchelet means wool dyed with the blood of a specific creature called the chilazon. All other blue is no good. And it's prohibited. God says, I'll take a person to task if he plays games and tricks people. He makes it blue. Yeah?
Any questions with
Marsha?
As we go.
Where does it say you can't dye them?
The word tchelet by definition means wool, specifically the material wool dyed with the blood of the chilazon. That's the definition of the word tchelet.
Okay, where does it say in the Torah?
Let's start again.
The Torah doesn't say chilazon, so where does that come from?
That definition we have on tradition. That's what the tchelet means, just like Argaman has a specific definition, and Tolat Shani has a specific definition. Each one of those is wool dyed with a specific color. That's the definition of the word. Yeah.
Back to Shmuel's question. The prohibition against dyeing it blue and faking it, that only applies if you're selling it, correct? We can do it for ourselves, right?
I don't think so. I think it's maybe.
The person
look it up again.
Who fakes the tefillah and sells it, he gets in trouble. But does it really apply to just?
I think one version of the quote is that God says, "I will take the person who fakes the color and puts it in his garment." If I'm not mistaken, there is such a quote as well. You're right, there's a quote that says about someone who sells it, that's the Gemara in Sota. I think in Menachos the Gemara says who puts it in his garment. I think. I might be wrong. I have to look it up. Yeah? Again? We can't go back to that. We gotta move forward. Sorry. But tomorrow night. No, Yosef, tomorrow night. Besides Hashem. The Torah tells us what happens if a person marries a woman and then he doesn't like her, so he gives her a bad reputation. And he says, oh, she cheated on me between the engagement and the marriage. And then they prove that he's a liar. So then there's a specific punishment for him. And from here we learn the concept of Hotzat Shem Ra, the biblical prohibition against making rumors for people. The Torah tells us if a man cheats with a woman, a married woman, they both get the death penalty. The Torah describes the laws if a person is seduced, the laws of rape. The Torah tells us rape is equal to murder. If a person sees someone raping a girl, he may kill the person. The Torah equates rape with murder. The Torah tells us that there's a prohibition against the ptsua daka. If a person had his male organ slit or his gonads crushed, so he is not supposed to get married within the Jewish people. So he can marry a gioret. There are certain women he could marry, just like a person who is a bastard. And technically, a bastard, that's something that continues down the line. What's a bastard? If a person, his grandmother, got divorced, and she never got a kosher divorce, and then she got remarried and had his father. So now, technically, she was married to the first guy, and then she married the second guy. She never got a kosher divorce. So then the child that comes from that union is a mamzer, is a bastard. And all his children for generations to come are mamzerim. Now, what happens if a person had this problem? He had a slit, or today we have I'm a moel, right? I do circumcision. So one of the common things that we have, 1 in 100 or 1 in 200 babies are born, that the male organ looks normal, but the urethra, the tubes really come out of a different place. It's called hypospadias or arthrospadias, depending on whether it's coming up from the top or the bottom. You look at the organ, everything looks fine. Doctors usually miss it. We catch it, the mohalim. But where it urinates from, there's a little hole down here, somewhere around the organ, not at the top, not where you'd expect it. So they have a whole procession. What they do is basically they open it like the way you'd open a drill, how it opens, rip. So they slice the whole thing open today, they fix the canal, and they sew it all shut. So is that this? I mean, he was slit open. So the Talmud says that even in the Talmud's times, they had ways of fixing it medically. Once it's fixed, it's fixed. They have nothing to worry about. Prus Shokhev, they fixed it, and now he could have kids. So that's fine. One of the halachas that are derivatives of this that apply today is that when you go to the bathroom, take a look after you go. If the floor is wet, so you're supposed to dry it out. Take a tissue, and a few tissues, put them on the floor so it's dry. Because in the Talmud's time, they didn't have ways of fixing it. So it was pretty common that people had... they had ways of fixing certain types, and they didn't have ways of fixing other types. So if a person left the bathroom and there was a puddle, so people started saying, oh, he can't have kids. So where are his kids from? So rumors started spreading about people. So the Talmud says, if you see there's a puddle, then don't leave a puddle. Make sure when you go, people can never say something after you. Today, I don't think anyone's saying any rumors, and if you go to a public bathroom, so it could be from anyone before you or anyone after you, but it's not nice, because the next guy might get his pants wet. So if a person leaves puddle, you should dry it. This is a complaint that I get every year from guys here, so I'm mentioning it again. Usually it's not in the first week, though. Yeah?
God forbid you get captured in war. Yeah? Somebody crushes your testicles on purpose, like torture.
Right.
And you're a Jew, and then like your enemy, does this, and you're just, that's it?
I don't know. I don't know how that works. I don't know. But these are questions that come up. Yeah? Ooh, that's a great question. With 5 minutes left, let me ask you a different question. Why is a child that's born handicapped being punished for something that's out of his control? So that do they bother you equally, or is one not bother you? So let's discuss both of them tomorrow night, because they're the same concept.
You're not punishing the mother. It's just the bloodline, the way it works.
You're right. It's a spiritual handicap. It's just like a person can be born with a handicap, this guy's born with a spiritual handicap.
So then we have... It's not a punishment. They just make a love.
100%. But then we have to discuss, okay, so we didn't answer the question, really. We just equated it, and we doubled the question. So that, if we have a chance tomorrow night, we'll discuss. Yeah? I don't know how that works. Sorry. Yeah.
Can you explain the pasuk Tov Zayin Tochet?
Which chapter?
22.
Oh, way back there.
Shlishi.
Shlishi?
Yeah.
We just read that. There are two different things, Tov Zayin and Tochet. Tov Zayin, I explained. Tochet. Let's discuss it after class, okay?
Yeah.
Let's just move forward. The Torah prohibits Ammonites and Moabites from marrying into the Jewish people. Only the males are prohibited, and today, ever since Sancheriv came and exiled everyone from their different locations, we don't know who's Ammon, we don't know who's Moab, we don't know who is Amalek. What we do know is that the reason behind the prohibition is that they placed a boycott on us. They said, we're not selling them anything. And that's something to think about. All these nations, those of you who don't really care between Coke and Pepsi, think back to the Arab boycott, who sold us, who didn't sell us. We see that the Torah says we bear a grudge. If you guys boycotted us just because we're Jewish, okay. Then we have what to talk about.
I said Jews aren't supposed to bear grudges.
An individual Jew is not supposed to bear a grudge. Okay. Okay. The Jewish people as a people are not supposed to let other people trample them. Okay. There's a difference between the people and the individual. The people are a representation of God. Just like a king, there are times when a king can't forgo his honor. It's not his honor he's forgone.
Rabbi, if you have an operation on your testicles,
each situation and each person will have to ask the local Orthodox rabbi. There are too many details, you understand? I mean, there are many details.
It doesn't force a man to get divorced, though, if he's already married, all right?
every situation, every personal life. You're talking about halachot that I have 7 volumes at home on this. You're asking a question like, okay, yeah. You know how many details, depends on how many scenarios. I mean, okay. The Torah says, don't seek out their peace. King David erred in that. When the Ammonite king lost his father, he sent them words of condolence, and he brought about a tremendous war that almost destroyed the Jewish people. The Torah says, remember, what they've done to you, don't seek out the peace of the Ammonites and Moabites. The Torah says, you go out to war, be careful that there shouldn't be anything bad in your camp, because God is in the midst of your camp. When we go to war, we view it as we're going with God. God is with us. And from here we derive many laws of purity. Our sages say the camp that we describe when we go out to war is not only a description of the Jewish camp at war, it's a description of every Jew. Every Jew is God's camp in this world. Every one of us has that job and that potential. And being that we're hitting the end, so we'll pick up over here tomorrow, I want to end with one thought. The book of Tehillim begins, Ashrei Ha'ish, praised is the person who delves in God's Torah, and works and works and works, and uv'torato yegei yomam v'layla, and day and night he's dealing in his Torah. Our sages say, when the person started learning, it's described as God's Torah. By the end of the verse, it's described as his Torah. From here we derive, you put your strength into it, the Torah is yours. There are points in the Torah that no one can get but you. Every single one of you has areas in Torah which you can discover. Maybe not today, maybe tomorrow, maybe in a month, maybe in a half year, maybe in a year. But there are areas of Torah that every person can discover, and there is Torah written on your name, waiting in Shemayim. The only one that can bring it down to earth is you. So, Be'ezrat Hashem, we just learned that every one of us is Hashem's camp here on earth. We should merit to do Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name down below, and Be'ezrat Hashem also to discover God's Torah that's within us. I hope everyone's coming tomorrow night. Please, if you haven't planned on it yet,